Welcome to the Paid Search Podcast. My name is Chris Schaefer, and we're going to talk about Google Ads. In fact, you guys are controlling the show today. I am answering questions from my website where you can send in questions. Many of you have done that. If you would like to join the show when I do this massive answering of listener questions, you can do so at paidsearchpodcast.com. Submit your question there, and I read all the questions, and I keep a queue of them and try and get around to all of them. So today we have a couple different questions and a big topic that a lot of people send questions about. I'm also going to have Joey Bidner to address one topic that we're going to get to soon. Other questions have to do with bid adjustments, automated bids, as well as discussions about a little bit of manual bidding and other important factors around that. So stay tuned. We have a lot of really different topics coming in today. Before I go further, I want to remind you about Opteo.com/PSP. More about that a little bit later in the show. All right, so we're going to skip the metric of the week. We're not doing a topic of the week. I'm going to devote the entire show to the questions that you guys are sending in. A couple weeks back, begged everyone to send some more questions because I was not getting questions, and I love to have a discussion with my audience, and you guys did exactly that. Now I've got a plethora of questions, and so let's knock out a few of them that came in recently. The first one comes from Bernadette, who's written in many times in the past, well, a couple times in the past at least. So Bernadette, question is, hi Chris, still loving your podcast. I have a question for you. I have heard that bid adjustments don't matter on automated bidding. Is that true? If so, are some bid adjustments applied and some ignored or overridden in order to allow automations to work? Or are some bid adjustments on automated campaigns just an exercise in futility? So the answer, Bernadette, is yes. The bid adjustments do not matter on automated bidding. So if you are adjusting bids for a max conversions or a target CPA for that kind of bidding structure, a bidding structure based on conversions, where you're telling Google, I want to optimize for conversions, you basically give up your control of those different bidding strategies, like audiences, time of day, location. You cannot adjust all of those factors. There's only one thing that you can do for max conversions and target CPA, and also max ROAS and target ROAS. You can block device types. So if you only want to show up for computers, if you only want to show up for mobile or tablet or something like that, you can block the other device types by putting a negative 100 in place, but a positive 10% or a positive 50%, those are effectively ignored. As you said, it's an exercise in futility, as you put it, Bernadette. So not something that's really going to make any difference. It is ignored entirely. Now, there are other bidding strategy types that are automated that do make a difference. For example, if you use max clicks, that does accept bidding strategies, or excuse me, that is a bidding strategy that is automated that does accept bid adjustments at the device level or, you know, other levels that aren't just negative 100. So hopefully that helps. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in the future, about automated bids and manual bids and, you know, what you give up and what you lose and what you gain by using different strategies. We're going to talk about that in the future, but I'll save that for later. Bernadette actually has another question that she sends in the same email. And she asks, can we talk about audience segments for lead generation search campaigns? Is this something that is more effective for display, or can it also be used to improve search campaigns? Great question. And I want to say this. It is absolutely valuable to look at your audience segments for a search campaign. It is not just something that is useful exclusively for display. I'll tell you this, if you listen to this podcast much at all, then you've heard my 10 principles of Google Ads discussion, which is not finished yet, but I kept it at 10 for right now, and we'll go further later. But basically, if you follow my 10 principles of Google Ads, then you do not really need to apply audience segments during step one or maybe even step two of Google Ads. I don't find that it's something that anyone really needs to focus on until you start to approach a point where you're hitting KPIs. When you're hitting your target ROAS, when you're hitting your target CPA, at that point, now you can start breaking keywords into other questions. Like, okay, so when these people search this keyword, what about the different types of people? What about the different age groups? What about the different audiences that these people are a part of? I think that's an appropriate time to start asking yourself those questions. The wrong time is when you're still in phase one. Essentially, when you're not even really getting conversions, when you're not really winning anything, you're not actually producing any value from your account, don't take a campaign that doesn't have significant conversion numbers and start looking at audiences, because that is complicating something that does not need to be complicated yet. So if you're moving into phase three, certainly phase four of Google Ads, you're getting conversions, you're happy with your performance, you want to scale, you want to improve, really want to ramp this up, that is a good time to do it. One more tip is I would suggest only adding audiences that are relevant to the kind of traffic or the kind of product or service that you're selling. So for example, if you are a plumber, I don't suggest that you add dog lovers as an audience for your plumbing campaign. That has no relative value about whether a person's a dog lover or not. So that should tell you that there's going to be a lot of audiences in this massive list of audiences that Google gives us that you should not add. And you say, well, Chris, why? What if dog lovers purchase more often? I need to know that. Well, no, you don't, because what is actually true is a person's going to be attached to many different audiences. And if you add 400 audiences, Google's going to be forced to attach these to an obscure number of different ones, and therefore you're missing out on the critical information that you might need to know. So for example, if a person is a dog lover, that would not matter if you're a plumber. What might matter is that they're also a business owner or a homeowner or someone who buys a lot of luxury goods, right? This would imply the income level or something valuable about your business that might be interesting and cause you to potentially be more likely to sell a bigger product, a bigger service to that person. That is interesting information. Dog lover is not necessarily something that's going to help you a lot in determining the value of that click or that person. So choose your audiences wisely, pick something that makes sense to what you're trying to sell, and start there. Now, one more thing that Bernadette actually said, and I saved this until after I went through her question, because I have to tell you, at the end of her first email, she said, I'm finally going to give Opteo a try. And then she sent another email, and I thought this was just great, because guys, if you don't believe me, Bernadette's going to do the Opteo read for the day. She says, Chris, I see the light now. Opteo is what you say it is. I see things in different ways, and I have very helpful information at my fingertips, helping me make crucial decisions. I can't believe it took me this long to give it a try. Ladies and gentlemen, I did not make that up. Bernadette is a real person. You go back and listen to episodes in the past. She's emailed before. She finally gave Opteo a try, and she's like, wow, Chris is not making this up. It is actually useful. So thank you, Bernadette, for telling everybody why they should try out Opteo. And if you're interested, you can try it for free for 2 months, just like Bernadette did, and discover and see the light, as she describes, at opteo.com/PSP. That's opteo.com/PSP to try this amazing tool that I am not joking about. That's why I talk about it every single week. It's a great sponsor, and I fully support them, and you'll love it to get your hands on this amazing deal. So let's move on to the next question. The next question comes from Hamza. Sounds right to me. Hey, Chris, I'm a regular listener of your podcast, and your focus on manual bidding strategies has really helped me a lot in my professional career. Pausing here. Thank you very much. I absolutely realize that a lot of people think that I am ridiculous and silly and, you know, just a stubborn, dumb Google Ads manager to stick to manual bidding as my core primary bidding strategy that I use for my clients and my training and my consulting, my podcast that I do. I am glad to hear that you guys still are appreciating that, because I've gotten people that have emailed me and, you know, told me that I've seen videos and, you know, people absolutely calling manual bidders, you know, basically fools. So I'm going to talk about this maybe more. I actually have considered having someone on my show that directly disagrees with me and maybe having a discussion on the show. We're going to see about that. So stay tuned for that. That will be a very interesting talk if I can get them on with me. All right, so here's a question. Usually I go through my search terms and see a certain term that has less impressions but greater clicks. Seems rather illogical. Why do you think that happens? For instance, there's 2 impressions but 5 clicks. All right, so Hamza, I believe the reason this happens is because a person can double click or a person can hit the back button. And there might be some other third way that possibly that this can happen. But basically, the input is given more times than the search is done. So if a person clicks twice, maybe 3 times if they're really fast, Google's going to register that click. And if they hit the back button, essentially that page is not refreshed or researched, that there's no additional impression that happens there. And that person clicks that same ad again. Maybe they are opening things in multiple tabs and they just don't ever close the tab and open it and then close that page and then realize, actually, no, I wanted that page, and they click on it again and open it a third time, second time, something like that. That is when you would have multiple impressions with only, multiple clicks with only less impressions than clicks. So it's unfortunate. I hate to see it, but I don't think it's a scam or a con or anything that's broken in the system. I think it's just the way that people navigate and use Google. And we, advertisers, get charged every single time someone clicks. So if they click twice during one impression, that's going to be another charge. So it's not ideal, but it happens all the time. Okay, so another question from Hamza says, secondly, I want to ask you if branded competitor keywords are actually a bad thing. Okay, so I brought this question in because I talk about this a lot, and this is definitely one of my more controversial opinions. And so I'm happy to discuss it again. Let's hear what he has to say. I know you don't like them, but my theory is that once you start getting impressions for a competitor's branded keyword, it could help in building brand awareness. For instance, I'm selling vaccinations in the UK. Now, if someone searches a competitor name, I could show up and potentially attract the person to see my rates, and maybe he chooses to try my service at a better price. What do you think? Well put, and you're absolutely right. You are generating interest where interest did not previously exist. Let's go through first the benefits and the good things about what's being accomplished here. So number one, you're definitely generating interest where someone had no idea that you even existed. Okay, so there's definitely some value there. I see if I search for a company name that's very well known, there will always be secondary advertisers that will show up that I've never heard of, and I might even click on them. I might ignore them. You know, I might click on them and hit the back button immediately once I land on their site and realize it's not what I want. Or I might actually investigate it and say, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so there's definitely what you're calling brand awareness. Now, the negative. If you've done this, if any of you out there have run competitor ads where you're advertising just on your competitor's name, you know that you're paying pretty high cost per click for this, because your quality score is really going to suffer because you can't use your competitor's name in the ad copy. So therefore, quality score is going to hurt. Also, it's not on the landing page, and there's nothing relevant about this to what you're selling. So in many factors, it's going to be a very low quality score. So therefore, your ad rank is going to be low. So you must bid high in order to achieve a ranking for this keyword. So your clicks, your cost per click is going to be higher than usual. So now, you're telling me that you're willing to pay a higher cost per click for brand awareness from someone who has no interest in you based upon the fact that they searched for something else, right? They are asking for A, and you just are serving them Z, right? And you're paying more for that opportunity. I don't think this is a good investment in brand awareness. Brand awareness, I think, should be pretty cheap. Brand awareness should happen at a very affordable price, because brand awareness works for high volume. Brand awareness is something that's important when you generate a lot of it. And therefore, by generating a lot of it, you want it to be more affordable. Brand awareness usually comes in the form of, you know, billboards and radio ads, TV ads, display campaigns, or very high funnel search campaigns. Why are these usually the ways that people will do brand awareness? Well, it's because it's the cheapest way to spread the message with a very low budget, not having to spend a ton of money. It's a very inefficient way of doing brand awareness, if you ask me. Now, one alternative that I definitely engage in a limited capacity, is I will show on competitor searches when they do things like competitor name plus pricing, competitor name plus reviews, competitor name plus some type of term that implies they're not paying or directly using that competitor yet, but they're researching that competitor. That's a great opportunity because it's going to be higher cost per click, but the volume is much, much less. Okay, so much less volume there. And also, this person is not committed to that competitor yet. They're looking them up. Review, pricing. This is someone who's not committed, and they might think, oh, actually, there's this other company. And if maybe you put your price right in the ad copy and make it, as you said, Hamza, you said, try my services at a better price. So I'm assuming that you have a lower price. So great opportunity for someone who has not yet subscribed to the other product or purchased the other product or engaged with those services yet. Great opportunity for you to insert yourself into that conversation. There's a lot of ways that you can do that. I see a lot of people that do keywords like competitor name with alternative, you know, so Nike alternative, you know, something like that. Nike pricing, Nike competitors, possibly. You know, that's an example of how you might use a competitor with these actionable research terms. Could be very interesting. And that is really about as far as I go for branded competitor awareness building. I do not engage in direct competitor names. I don't find that it's a good use of time at all. So, okay. Now, for the last question, I don't have anyone in particular that has sent this in, but this is something I've gotten in different ways on Twitter and things like that and email. And people are asking about the new consent mode. So the EU or the consent mode of websites and mobile apps, which has recently come into existence, is something that people really need to know about. This is something that I don't know very much about, but I'm very glad to have a frequent guest who can expound on this more often or more accurately than me, and that is Mr. Joey Bidner. So, Joey, will you please explain to the audience, what is consent mode on websites, mobile apps? How does it apply to them? Who needs to know about this? Take it away.
Hey, Chris. So today we're going to be talking about consent mode. So consent mode version 2 is a new requirement that applies to any advertiser advertising in Europe or the UK. Now, I'm going to repeat this. This is anybody advertising to Europe and the UK. This does not just apply to businesses in Europe, but anybody advertising there. So if you are a Canadian, US-based or Australian company, whatever, advertising in your own country, but also have campaigns going to Europe, including the UK, this applies to you. And it's critically important because consent mode version 2 requirements, they made us aware of them in September and said that there would be a deadline of March 7th to implement them. And essentially what consent mode is, they are those cookie consent banners that you often see on websites. If you ever go to any website from Europe, it's like on 100% of them because consent mode requirements are nothing new in Europe. But what's changed is, one, there's a few new pieces of data that are in this new update called, you know, consent mode version 2. A few new pieces of data that weren't previously in the, you know, previous consent mode. But most importantly, it's this requirement from Google to have it in order for remarketing to work, as well as for something new called conversion modeling. So the biggest impact will be remarketing. If you don't have consent mode V2 launched on the site and properly integrated into your Google Ads account through Google Tag Manager, for example, your remarketing audiences will no longer continue to populate. Now, it's not to say that your remarketing will just shut off completely, but the audiences will dwindle down as, you know, they won't continue to populate for new users. And then in terms of how it affects your conversions, so if somebody rejects the consent to be tracked, we cannot see if they converted through an ad click. Until now, with this consent mode V2, the advanced version, where it does, through means of some black box that I don't quite understand, it does essentially model the conversion to give you some of that conversion data back. How that works, I'm not quite sure. And there's a lot of speculation on, you know, there's a lot of speculation on how that's going to work. But the big thing is for remarketing and also just general compliance. We want to be compliant with these new laws regarding consent. So in order to get started with it, you basically, it's quite simple, actually, once you know what to do. It's only a few simple steps. So you do need to get a consent banner on your site. There's a number of ways to do that. I will recommend, like 100% of the time, you should use something called a CMP, a consent management platform. And Google has given a list of about 30 different platforms that are directly compliant with their integration. And this will make your life so much easier. If you try to do some custom consent system, in order to get that integrated to Google Ads will be a nightmare. So by picking one of the compliant ones, integrating it is honestly as simple as, well, first you sign up for it, which, I'm not going to lie, they're not free, but they're not expensive. You can then, design your banner, pick the things you want to ask for, and then each one of these consent platforms will give you a little code, right? Then you go to Tag Manager, you set up a new tag for this consent platform. Every consent planner platform that's compliant will have like a custom template associated directly for them. You put that code in there, and then boom, it's connected. Then you just need to go to your admin settings. In your admin and container settings, you'll see a new little checkbox that says enable consent mode. And this is what will allow you to then even see which of your tags are collecting the consent data parameters, and all of the Google Ads and Google Analytics tags automatically have this built in to collect that data. So once you plug in your compliant CMP and enable this consent mode in the container settings, and the actual name of it is Enable Consent Overview in the additional settings. Once you do that, that's pretty much it. The only thing you need to do further is if you have, let's say, any third-party conversion tracking, such as, let's say you have a, let's say you run your LinkedIn conversion tracking through Tag Manager, then that won't be automatically connected because it's just the Google ones that are really automatically integrated to this. So when it comes to picking a CMP, I prefer Cookiebot, just because I found the most tutorials for it online. But it's very easy to set up. Once I kind of, got up to speed on what this whole thing is and why it's important and how to do it, it's very easy to set up, because it's compliant with Google. So I would say that, yeah, if you're an advertiser running ads in Europe or the UK, I can't suggest strongly enough that right after this call, the first thing you do, well, the first thing you should do after this, listening to this podcast, is obviously go try Opteo. But then the second thing should be that you read up on Consent Mode V2. You get a consent banner firing from one of these Google approved CMPs. And integrate it. We will leave a link in the show notes that brings you to some Google documentation that has this large list. And one more thing I do want to mention is when it comes to firing that consent banner, you can choose what countries you want it to fire in. So it doesn't have to be account wide, where, it doesn't have to be firing in America where it's not required. Right, you can choose that it's only going to fire in Europe or the UK where it is required. Users have to opt out instead of opt in. So anyways, I hope that's helpful. If anybody needs any further assistance or have questions, feel free to find me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, or book a consultation with me through my website. And yeah, hope that's helpful. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Joey. And you guys can find more information on the details of the podcast wherever you're listening or watching. If you're on YouTube or if you're in your podcast app, there will be a link to Joey's website, my website, and also to send a question into the show. You can do that. I appreciate you guys listening and sending feedback. I have lots more questions to go through. If you didn't get an answer, please send it in again, or send in more if you have them. I'm always accepting questions. Thank you guys for being here. I will catch